to have you with us. It's been a great morning so far. Hope your coffee's been good. The milk you put in it was sweet, and the sugar was sweeter. I'm sitting here in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, with my friend and my leader, the president, founder, and director, CEO of Enlightened Radio, John Case.
All right. Thanks for that, man.
Yeah, sure, man.
I felt like I should have brought a little pet lion out with me.
Yeah, pet lion.
Well, you know, like a lion tamer, you know, just show that...
That you're cool?
And you got some...
Mojo?
Mojo, something. Yeah. Right? You know, have the lion sit down and do a little purr.
You know, speaking about mojo, before this show is over, we should play Hoodoo Man.
Hoodoo Man? I got that one. I do have that.
Junior Wells and Buddy Guy. It's a great song. We've got a great show today. We have a wonderful guest. John is going to be playing a bigger role in this show, so he's co-hosting this show with me. You know, John started this whole thing, and, you know, I'm very fortunate that on Wednesday mornings he comes in, you know, to engineer for me, because he's got this thing set up with two boards, three computers, and two microphones and telephone, and I can't figure it all out. I'm just too dumb to figure it all out. So John comes in to engineer with me.
Just one piece at a time. One piece at a time. It's just like the road to salvation, man.
One step at a time.
One little electron at a time.
That's the road to salvation.
Well, it's as good as the established religion's path to salvation. By the way, every one of which includes some time in the casket. Okay. So, no matter what they tell you, all right, sister.
You know, whatever you just said, John, ain't nothing like my dad, the Baptist preacher's road to salvation. I don't know what you were talking about, but
I'm saying the road to salvation. You need to focus on the here and now, the salvation that is that may attend us, or, you know, possibly our children.
Well, definitely should focus on the here and now.
Someone's calling in here.
Let's see who this is.
Good morning. This is Enlightened Radio. Who's calling?
This is Peter Olney calling in.
Peter!
How are you, brother?
How you doing, man?
Hi, Peter. This is John Case. Yeah. Remember we had dinner 30 years ago?
Yeah.
I think it was at my house.
Peter, I got to reintroduce you to John Case. He was a UE organizer back in the day.
We knew each other back then.
In L.A., when you were with SEIU, I think.
Is that who you were working for? I think it was 85 or 86, because I remember you came out to our house, and Umberto and his wife were there, and his wife brought this unbelievable ceviche with her. My friend Robert Garcia.
What John?
Would have been 85, 80, 80, maybe 84, 85. I was in Los Angeles from what, 80... let's see, about 84 to 87, something like that. I don't know. How you doing?
At that time, I was working for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union in Los Angeles.
Okay, all right, all right, yeah. all right, okay, yeah.
So that's why you were doing L.A. MAP, right?
L.A. MAP was not until 94.
Oh, man. Peter, I'm so sorry.
Is when we started LA MAP.
I'm so sorry. Peter, give us a rundown. Give us a resume.
Yeah, please. I want 30 years worth of history, Peter, right now. Come on.
it doesn't have to be detailed, brother.
It's great to reconnect with you. I know your name. I still have a deep fondness for the UE.
Well, that's good because, you know, like all, it appears the stars are receding from the heavens, however, and become... less bright as time goes on.
Well,
that's a sign that we're engaged in a rapid escape from the solar, from the universe, perhaps. Maybe we're. I see another space drama, space opera coming to play here. Trump is driving us freaking crazy.
John Case has just been invaded by Frank Zappa. So, what year did
trouble
you,
coming
did
every
you
day.
Graduate from Harvard, Peter?
I never did. I was me and Bill Gates.
Yeah, that's right. As both of you.
When did you? I dropped out in 71.
Oh man!
And I started working Then I went to Italy for a year, and that's where I got extremely radicalized by Italian politics. And then when I came home, I quit school and went to work. And in 1973, I worked in a machine shop in Roxbury, where I organized that shop into the United Electrical Workers, Local 262.
Oh, 262, and, right. That's right. I can't remember a guy named Phil Mamber. Phil Mamber, right. Did he come out of that local?
Hey, John. This is okay, not
sorry,
old.
Sorry.
This is old, not
I did it again.
Old white guys tripping down the memory lane.
Anyway, go ahead.
He was a good guy. He and I crossed swords at that time.
Oh, he crossed swords with everybody, but he was a good guy. Yeah, yeah.
And then where?
Yeah, so... the UE was my beginning, and I still have a deep fondness for that organization. And I've been working a lot with Peter Knowlton recently on the Labor for Bernie aftermath, trying to hold the six unions together that supported Bernie. So, you know, he continued. The union plays an important role, even though its numbers are diminished.
Right.
That's true.
So what's happening with the Labor for Bernie thing? The unity of the six unions.
John, let's let him introduce himself.
Oh, well, okay, Peter, go ahead. There I go again.
Yeah. Well, I've been a labor organizer for 45 years, and I retired in 2013 from the International Longshore and Warehouse Union as organizing director. That's where I got to know Stuart, because I would come to organizing directors' meetings that he convened in when he was the director of organizing for the AFL-CIO.
Where we first met, Peter.
Since retirement, I've been working with the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way, which is one of the old railroad craft unions.
Right.
They decided 2.5 years ago that they were in need of a program to reestablish contact with their members. And so they hired Gene Bruskin and I to work as consultants. And we put together a national program for them called the Communications Action Team. And they just doubled the program and hired 5 more organizers.
Great.
So I'm very proud of what they're doing.
Great. That's excellent. Wonderful.
Yeah, it's exciting. And so we're going to have a national day of action in early May. It will be cross-craft railroad workers protesting to preserve their health care plan. The railroads, the powerful and grossly rich railroads, want to take away their health care and mainstream it. So these railroad sisters and brothers are going to be protesting key railroad junctions all over the country in early May. So that's an exciting
That's great. And what can our listeners do to be involved in that?
Well, they can reach out to me at
Peter Olney, O-L-N-E-Y.
Yeah, Peter Olney, O-L-N-E-Y. My email is Olney, O-L-N-E-Y, ROM, R-O-M, at IGC.org. And you can, onlyrom@gmail.com. Yeah. Reach out to me there, and I'll be glad to supply you with more information.
That's great. Well, we got to do I really want to get into this question of patriotism and internationalism and what is the smart thing, the strategic thing, the tactical thing for us on the progressive left to do, but also how can we do it and be consistent with our values. But before we get too into that, I have to give our listeners a little report on the state of the resistance. So just in the last couple of days, Senator Jeff Merkley, the junior senator from Oregon, has begun a resistance against the Neil Gorsuch confirmation, not a resistance, a filibuster against a Neil Gorsuch confirmation to the Supreme Court. He has, last I heard, he was still reading at 3 a.m. Now, this isn't just any filibuster. He is reading from the mistaken and the wrong-headed and the conservative and the right-wing opinions of Neil Gorsuch. So he's using this filibuster to argue for why we cannot allow this man to sit on the Supreme Court. It's looking more and more like we're going to hold on to our 40 votes to maintain the filibuster and to force the majority, Mitch McConnell, to decide whether or not to blow up the Supreme Court filibuster or to send it back to Trump and to say, hey, you got to bring somebody else. So that's one thing that's going on. Secondly, I think Gorsuch is cooked. I think he's toast. Because it's just turned out that his book that came out in 2006 is full of plagiarism, is full of plagiarized pages, plagiarized chapters that he didn't give any notice of nor citations for.
You mean he forgot to footnote?
Yeah.
Yeah, what did
he,
that, now, what did that
did
cost you?
He did more than forget to footnote. He didn't use
quotation marks. Maybe he was using air quotes when he was writing it. Okay.
He was, you know, probably the truth is that a guy like him, he probably doesn't write a book that has his name on it.
He's too busy. I mean, he's probably billing out at $1,000 an hour. Come on. You can't stop to write a book at that rate. You got to have someone do it for you.
Or you can do both at the same time.
And so you hire a right-wing college English major, which is probably somebody that can't even write a sentence, to do your stuff for you, and that's what you get.
Right. And so he seems to be cooked. Now, the Republicans, the right-wingers, went back to an old foe of theirs and are so happy to be back to attacking Susan Rice. You know, it occurred to me this morning, and maybe I'm wrong about this, John and Peter. I don't know. Maybe the GOP doesn't dislike all Democrats. Maybe the GOP just dislikes people of color and women. And
okay, so they like some. There's some guys in the Democrats that they have not insulted yet. I'm not sure, but
right.
Okay.
There's a few.
Okay.
So, Susan.
Joe Manchin, for example, have they actually insulted Joe yet?
That's no, the, they know. Haven't. Our own Joe Manchin here in West Virginia.
Let me ask you a question about the future of the Democratic Party. Can I ask
sure.
Peter that? Are our choices really either between? Is there anything between Joe Manchin and Bernie Sanders that to choose from really that matters?
Yeah.
Is there?
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot.
I mean
John Lewis.
Yeah, but
John Lewis.
Right, but are all those people that are on that are good? Are they getting pushed toward kind of like, for all practical purposes, half socialist positions on everything?
Well,
I mean, I'm just sort of sensing that's going.
Are you arguing against half socialist positions?
No, I am a half socialist. Okay?
I know you are.
I'm half half Quaker, half you know whatever. And I retired with a lot of money from Microsoft and Netscape. So I'm half capitalist.
Why
too.
Why haven't you shared some of that money with me?
I have.
Not very much. So.
Wait a minute. Did you see Peter? Did you hear a grievance there? You know, I mean, the high rates of pay here at Enlightened Radio are, I've doubled their pay twice, and they don't even notice it.
Hey, Peter, as my freshman in high school physical science teacher would say, Mr. Blau, who was a farmer in Southeast Missouri, would say. Ought times two is ought. Meaning zero times two is zero, John Case.
I know.
And so, but anyway, they're attacking Susan Rice because when she was national security advisor under President Obama, she took the time when she found out about discussions between Russia and the Trump campaign. She took the time to find out who was having these discussions, and they're now saying that she is the one who unmasked members of the Trump team in their discussions about Russia.
Good. She ought to get a Medal of Freedom for it.
And you know what? She will get a Medal of Freedom.
Oh, well, maybe. If we survive this whole thing.
Right. If we survive this whole thing is exactly right. Mm-hmm. meanwhile, the resistance continues hard and steady and on it over and over and over. And don't forget, brothers and sisters, friends and neighbors, ladies and gentlemen, that nothing on our side, nothing good happens in Washington without our pressure. This resistance is about what people at the grassroots do. And that means people in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia and people in South San Francisco, where Peter is from, and people in Boston, where Peter's mother is, and people in Tennessee and Southeast Missouri, where I'm from. Nothing good happens without us making it happen. And now we see that they're going to try another ACA overthrow. They have another bill they're working on, and Trump is going to push forward. And they're not going to get any further with that than they got in the last one, AHCA, going down to defeat. So, Peter, thank you so very much for coming on the program today. I mean, Peter is one of the people I respect the most in our movement. Truly a great organizer, a legendary organizer, spent 45 years organizing, known across the country by people who are serious about union organizing as really one of the leading figures. And a good and close friend of mine for, I don't know, since the mid-80s at some point, and even more closely during the 2000s when I was the organizing director of the AFL-CIO. But today, Peter and John and I want to have a wide-open discussion about patriotism and internationalism. And it seems to me that the radical right, the fascist right, the oligarchic right is giving up the mantle of patriotism for their greed, for their self-aggrandizement, for their self-enrichment, for their narrow special interests. Peter, John, what do you all think about that? Am I right or wrong, or does it make sense?
I can't figure out what the Trump administration seeks to accomplish in foreign policy at all. Frankly, I can't see any goal that he has declared that he's going to achieve as achievable, especially with the militarization of all the conflicts, which seems to be his only budgetary approach. He's eviscerated the State Department, so there's not going to be much diplomacy going on unless the military manages it, and they've
and Rex doesn't seem to be up to the task.
But I think that I it seems to me that one of the problems, though, is that we have to say that the established methods for managing globalization are not meeting hardly anyone's satisfactory expectations. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone's satisfied. You can talk to French farmers, you know, who you can say it's irrational that they want to protect their little small farming products, okay, over there. And in some, and in some, and in a certain global sense, I suppose it is irrational, okay, and protectionist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, products and how they're made are associated with ways of life, and it seems that somehow we have to find a way to a path toward having trade, which I don't think anyone can stop. And its impacts on the division of labor around the world. Because every time you set up a trading thing, well, now, you know, there's a certain kind of work being done differently across different borders, okay? And that means somebody has to change their job and perhaps get retrained or not, as the in this country. So we have the international relations, you know, and including all the way up to these, you know, big geopolitical conflicts like with Russia, although what are we really fighting about with Russia? I asked someone to actually explain that to me. You know, I think you have a tough, well, I think nobody knows because I talk to 10 people and I'll get 10 different answers completely. And so, but one of the ways to approach the question, and the one I've been emphasizing myself a lot, is that you can't control what other countries are going to do that much. Right. You can't go in and dictate to them, hey, we'll trade with you if you change your constitution. Well, how do they change their constitution? You know, I mean, or we'll trade with you if you're a different kind of country than you are. If you, you know, once you head into that territory, you know, you're if the situation fails, you're being asked to go in and fix it. But there's no fix that involves, you know, occupying some country or seizing all their assets or going to economic war with them. You know, we know that that doesn't work. So the best thing you can do is to, I think, is to set an example. And I'm following here Danny Roderick, the economist's advice on this, all the trade questions, really. And that is monitor your own behavior, okay? If, for example, if you get gains from a trade deal in your economy, which there's no reason to go into it for anybody unless you do get a gain in trade overall, a gain in value somehow. It's your business whether you distribute that wealth amongst your own citizen. And if you set an example and do so, right?
Yeah, I'm not convinced, John.
If you set an example and do so,
I'm not convinced.
Then you set a good example, John, for others.
John.
Okay, so but you have control over how you spend the gains in your country. You don't have control over how Mexico spends theirs.
Global capitalism is going to be affected by a good example?
It doesn't. I'm not talking.
That's what you just said.
Yes, I did. In other words, we have the power to tell basically agribusiness what they can sell their product for.
Yep, we do.
And whether it results in cheap food for American citizens.
Well,
we have the ability.
Theoretically, we have the power.
We have the ability to tax every international transaction.
Theoretically, we do.
Well, that's our power. We don't have the power to tell Russia, you know, why don't you well, we did tell them, okay, and a disaster resulted. The Washington Consensus in Russia was probably one of the worst things in the last 40 years.
And meanwhile...
Anyway, go ahead, Peter. It's your turn.
No, John.
No, it's not. It's your turn.
John!
Well, from my perch in California, let's look at NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Here's a deal that Trump ran against this, explicitly against NAFTA, as the evil that had caused the destruction of middle America and manufacturing jobs.
Hey man, come on.
Certainly true that since 1994, we've lost about 800,000 manufacturing jobs to Mexico. But in that same period, we lost 7 million manufacturing jobs overall. So NAFTA, while a problem, is not the sole reason for the destruction of our manufacturing base. There's international trade, there's other countries, and there's automation and the substitution of technology for labor. So Trump's appeal about NAFTA was largely the same as his anti-immigrant appeal, which is xenophobically blaming others for our problems. But here we have the moment where Trump is going to have to deal with renegotiating NAFTA. And it's going to be a similar moment to the ACA repeal and replace, because the elites in all three countries like NAFTA. They'd like to see some tweaking, but they like NAFTA. And Trump is going to be between a rock and a hard place in terms of what replacing and repealing NAFTA looks like. And we're going to have an opportunity to raise the issue of worker standards, environmental standards, in all three countries, and build some trinational unity around that. The other thing that this whole anti-Mexico bashing thing is doing is creating a very favorable moment in Mexico, where you have an election in 2018, and the man who is polling number one by an overwhelming margin is Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, who is a left-wing politician who some think won the last election and has maintained a sort of shadow government, advancing a progressive platform. So it's very likely that this man could be elected president of Mexico, which would really shake up the balance of forces and would be a direct result of Trump's jingoist anti-Mexico posturing, which has driven the approval ratings of the incumbent Mexican president below 10%. So with NAFTA and the possible renegotiation of NAFTA, left forces in labor and the environmental movement are going to have a huge opportunity, just as forces around healthcare had the opportunity to advance single payer. So let's grab this opportunity and run with it.
It's a great point, Peter. Thank you very much, man. Which party is he from? I'm sorry. Give me his name again. And
well,
the party.
He like all Mexican politicians, came out of the PRI party, which is the longstanding yep. ruling party of Mexico. Then they splintered and became part of the PRD,
right?
Which was the party of Cárdenas,
right? The very progressive party.
And now
right.
he's created his own movement called Morena, which is a Spanish acronym for a movement of workers and environmentalists.
Great. That's awesome. What's his name again?
Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
Great.
AMLO. A-M-L-
Great.
A-M-L-O.
Well, as a tactic of resistance, the radical right, the fascist right, the oligarchic right appears to have ceded the mantle of patriotism. They appear to have given up the mantle of patriotism. And the question that John and I have been jawing about for a few weeks now is whether we on the left, or we progressives, can be patriots and at the same time be internationalists. Can we work in the best interests of America and at the same time exercise global worker solidarity, exercise some commitment to stop or slow down or reverse the global economic race to the bottom, and whether or not we can act as brothers and sisters to workers in other countries. You want to take a shot at that, Peter?
Well, that's what I think I'm trying to say about this NAFTA moment.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if you approach the NAFTA issue as solely through the lens of America first, you're dead on arrival in terms of both an understanding of the impact of NAFTA and also an understanding of how you build that solidarity, because NAFTA's impact, the most extreme impact, was probably in Mexico on small farmers in Mexico who have been devastated by American grain and foodstuffs imported into Mexico, flooding their markets and destroying small farm production. And that has caused a lot of folks to leave the land and migrate to, you know, border centers or migrate to Mexico City. And so if you understand the impact of NAFTA and where its toll has been greatest, you start to forge opportunities for solidarity in terms of speaking to the interests of workers in all three countries, U.S., Canada, and Mexico.
Right.
So being a patriot also involves being a internationalist.
Oh, that's a great point, Peter. That's a great point. Thank you.
I mean, I don't know if you guys, the topical story for me today was what happened yesterday at the North American Building Trades Union Legislative Conference in Washington, D.C., where
were
Trump
you there?
Came to speak.
Were you there?
No, I wasn't there, but I read Trump's speech, and I followed some of the coverage, and I want to give a shout-out to IBEW Local 569 from San Diego, who stood up in that conference and held up signs that said resist in front of Donald Trump when he was addressing the building trades. And this is an exciting development, what's happening here, because as you know, on the 23rd of January, Trump met with the several building trades leaders, including Sean Garvey, the head of NABTU, at the White House.
Right.
And since that time, things have been roiling within the trades about how to respond to that, because here's a president who calls himself a builder. Yeah, he can be a builder, but he's all about building non-union, about building without Davis-Bacon, and about building right to work. So there's a whole movement now, particularly within the IBEW, to oppose this stuff. The Electrical Workers Minority Caucus just issued a statement, solidarity pledge, and they also wrote a letter to Lonnie Stevenson, the president of the IBEW, asking that he oppose Trump. And yesterday, if you read Trump's speech, which is the White House's transcript of his speech, when he calls out the trades individually, iron workers, bricklayers, and there's loud applause, when he gets to the IBEW, there's total silence.
Wow.
And then he says, what about my local three in New York? And then there's a little bit of tittering of applause. But this is exciting what's happening. Even within the crusty old, you know, conservative building trades, you're starting to see resistance and movement. And the IBEW is an interesting case because, as you know, Stuart, 35 locals of the IBEW supported Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
And the president of that union, to his credit, did not endorse Hillary until after the Democratic convention. So he allowed 100 flowers to blossom within his union. So I look to this resistance as something that's very important, and something that we've got to keep an eye on, because Trump is very skillfully and shrewdly trying to manipulate one section of a labor movement against another. And this is very dangerous.
Very, very dangerous. A couple of things to drill down a little bit. The IBEW is the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. It is the most powerful and the richest of the building trades unions. You cannot build a skyscraper without IBEW electricians wiring it. So it's very important. The IBEW had the largest percentage of their members support Bernie of any union, even though they didn't endorse. And in a lot of places in America, the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, run the local labor movement or the state labor movement. So what they do in regards to Trump is really important to the whole labor movement. Now, when Peter was going through that, he mentioned a couple of things we may not know about. One is Davis-Bacon. Davis-Bacon is the federal law that has been copied at the state level and the local level, saying that no contractor on a government project shall pay wages that are less than the average wage paid to those workers in that area. And what that is for is to keep government construction work from undermining and undercutting private sector construction work. If you have for instance, when I was in Atlanta and you had, you know, $1.5 billion construction project on the Olympics, if it hadn't been done union, it would have destroyed the construction unions in Atlanta, because it would have taken such a large market share from the construction unions in Atlanta. So Davis-Bacon or prevailing wages is critically important. And right to work is simply an effort to weaken artificially weaken unions by saying that the negotiations between a union and an employer cannot allow for a union shop, and that's just a way to weaken labor unions. I have to say, and thank you for that positive outlook on the building trades right now, because I have to say that I fear, Peter, that our labor movement has not stepped up the way we should have on the Trump resistance. That you've got the president of the AFL-CIO making nice with Trump. You have the building trades doing what they've done. And some of it's understandable because jobs are involved. But I'm talking about it not because I want to criticize our labor movement, but because I don't want our friends and allies, people we've been in struggle with for a long time, people who've carried our water on the Employee Free Choice Act, on health care, and on a lot of other things. I don't want our allies to think that everybody in organized labor is willing to swallow whatever it takes to make up with Trump. And so I'm disappointed with what our movement has done so far, even though I'm ecstatically happy about the resistance. And, I keep focusing on, the incredible victories. The Muslim ban has been beat down by the democratic institutions of the judiciary. We stopped the Republican health care bill mainly by because the members of the Freedom Caucus wanted to destroy anything on health care, but also because thousands and thousands of Americans turned out for those town hall meetings before just before the vote on the on Trump care, or on Trump don't care, on Ryan care. Peter, I don't want to put you in a bad situation, but I guess I am. How do you respond to the way the labor movement has stepped up to the resistance?
Well, Stuart, I agree. I've been very concerned about the way Rich Trump has responded to this challenge, and certainly concerned about the North American Building Trades Union and their embracing of Trump. But then I do what's called dividing one into two and look at the other side of things. I look at the whole movement for Bernie within labor, Labor for Bernie, which had six national unions endorsing, 105 locals, and that organizing continues. And I think we're going to be able to coalesce a bunch of unions around an alternative vision of politics, which is crucial to moving any kind of political struggle in the labor movement. So I view that as a positive. And then I view what potentially is going to happen on May 1st this year when we have another day of a day without immigrants, and immigrants protesting Trump's racist, xenophobic policies towards them. And I see unions like United Service Workers West and the SEIU of your old unions,
Stuart, right,
who are committing to strike their 60,000 members in California.
That's
and
great.
The United Food
That's
and
amazing.
Commercial Workers and the hotel and restaurant employees, unions with huge immigrant membership base, talking about actively joining in protests and work stoppages around May 1st. And so I think we got to push our labor movement to link up in whatever way possible with those kind of activities. So I share your assessment, absolutely, Stuart, but I also see what happened yesterday at this NABTU meeting and legislative conference in Washington is very exciting for a bunch of IBEW members to stand up holding resist signs in front of the president. Was a wonderful development, and it's flying all around the internet right now.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So So, yeah, you're right. Rich really disappointed me. I mean, I loved his statements about voting for Obama and
right.
in 2008. I right. love what he did around Ferguson when he addressed the Missouri AFL-CIO. And I couldn't believe that he would talk about potential collaboration with Trump on immigration reform.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what he's smoking.
Yeah.
You know, this guy ran on a anti-immigrant platform.
Yeah.
So I would like to see Rich out there saying, let's support the immigrant workers on May 1st, not let's work with the president on immigration reform. But he's not there right now, so we got to move with the folks that are moving. And there are significant pieces of the labor movement, particularly in California, that are going to rise up on May 1st.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The approach is more and more unions are going to move in that direction.
What I keep getting over and over again as we talk about Trump and the resistance is I keep getting how the activists, the worksite leaders, the shop stewards, the presidents in small plants, the secretary treasurers in small plants who work full-time and then do the business of the union are stepping up in the Trump resistance. But I do think we have to be careful to remind our allies that we're not all following Rich Trumka on this silliness that he's doing with Donald Trump. Let me go to another point that I really wanted to get out today, and I'm going to ask you, Peter, and John to address this, and I'm just going to shut up for a minute. And that is, how do we imagine, you know, the radical right, the fascist right, the oligarchic right, acts like they don't care about the people of America anymore, if they ever did. But certainly they're not showing any signs of giving a rat's behind about the people of America. They don't show any signs of caring about America and the global in the worldwide context, in the global context. And so we have an opportunity to pick up the mantle of patriotism, something that big major parts of our labor movement never dropped. But what is the possibility of claiming the mantle of patriotism and acting in a positive worker solidarity way, a sort of new internationalism? Peter, John, either one of you?
Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I guess my patriotism is wrapped up in the vision of Senator Sanders from Vermont. I guess I feel like his clear articulation, and I don't think we've seen anyone in our lifetime, and I think you have to go back to Eugene Debs for somebody to articulate a clear pro-working class, anti-corporate, anti-Wall Street vision of what being an American is about. And having been a socialist all my life, but often hidden my socialist politics, I found it a liberating moment to see somebody articulate that kind of vision as that's what it means to be an American, is to be a socialist, and this is what a socialist is. And I feel like that socialism is 21st century American patriotism. And
say that again, Peter. Say that again.
Socialism is 21st century American patriotism. I'm frankly thrilled to see the millennials and these young people who are untarnished by the Cold War fears, who are stepping out and embracing that. I think it's wonderful to see the growth in the discourse around that, particularly among young people. So I think that's what we have to articulate. and not be afraid of that. I think many of us graybeards have often shrunk from putting our politics out there on Main Street, and I think that's probably hurt us.
I would say that it seemed that, that the patriotic aspect, in order to be not sucker bait for Trump types, either now or in the future, though, has to be multinational. Because, I mean, what is America? I mean, it's a country of many, many, many nationalities, and the global immigration patterns which follow globalization in general. You know, labor will follow capital, and capital will hunt down labor, you know. You know, make it so that the composition of each nation is going to be every nation.
Yeah.
I think that, like that, the source of internationalism is really learning, I think, the culture. How does a multinational culture develop in the United States? Because otherwise you can say, my idea of patriotism is to go back to what someone said 1950 was like. Or what someone said this was like. It has to connect with all different kinds of people. That's why I think the immigration fight, and I thought your remarks were very interesting, Peter, on that, and the possibilities of regime changes of a good, better kind in Mexico itself, all emphasize the importance of different peoples breaking bread together, don't you think?
No,
that's a good you're conditioning my remarks, because this issue of celebrating the multinational character of our country and recognizing particularly the special issue of the issue of Black people's slavery and emancipation and all of that needs to be celebrated as part of that vision that I presented of a socialist America. You know, absolutely.
And we come back to this point a lot on this show, which is America has a very radical history. You know, the history of America is average people, the working class, struggling, as President Obama used to say, for a more perfect union. The fight for independence from Britain, the struggle for the end of slavery that ultimately cost 650,000 lives, the struggle for the suffrage for women, the struggle against legalized segregation, the struggle for women's rights, the ERA, the struggle for the modern civil rights movement, the struggle for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered freedom. You know, it's a very, very radical history, and it is very American to fight to make the country live up to the promises of the founders. And that's why I don't lose faith in the resistance to Trump. The American working class has lived up to this challenge time after time after time, and I think we will this time as well. So, and I would ask both of you to address this, John and Peter. You know, the definition of a patriot is, and I looked it up this morning about 4 in the morning when I was trying to prepare for this show, is a commitment to one's country and looking out for the best interests in one's country. It seems to me that you cannot hate the people of a country and love that nation. And so it also seems to me that now that, you know, John and I talk about this a lot on the radio, now that we've had 4 decades, 40 years of stagnant wages, declining benefits, and almost the evisceration of the entire notion of a pension, and now the assault that's coming on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. It seems to me that to really be a patriot, to really want what's best for a nation, you also have to be on the side of the people of that nation. And one of the things that is bedeviling us is what John was getting at earlier, which is, you know, the global economic race to the bottom and the serious competition, maybe a false claim, I don't know, that employers and corporate America continue to say American workers have to compete with the worst wages in the world. And it seems to me that really, if you're trying to do what's best in the best interests of this country, you ought to be trying to stop the global economic race to the bottom. John, Peter?
How do you do that? There's two. One theory of says that you can't. I saw an article just yesterday, as a matter of fact. Will growth solve the right-wing populist problem? Could economic growth solve it? In other words, if you could grow the pie fast enough, would that make it possible to do alleviate the economic pressures, right, that are cranking this whole thing? And I that's a difficult question to answer for lots of complicated reasons, and it's very difficult to picture having a global market really, and not having workers and companies compete against each other. The big question is that, you know, competition over time, if you end up in some like long-range progressive substitution of capital for labor, in other words, you become a more technological society as time goes on, without having, these gilded age scenarios, right? I mean, 1914, the rich are soaking up everything in the world, okay? And eventually World War One happens, okay, over the thing. And now we've got, if Mr. Piketty, and our favorite economist, is right, we're right there again.
Right.
Boy, it's hard to see past the dangers, isn't it? I mean,
it's very hard.
It's very tough.
Right. But it is not in the interest of the United States to be isolationist.
Well, no, but on the other hand, how to engage? I mean, what do you do about Syria? Slightest idea. Okay.
God only knows.
But I mean, Syrian refugees start coming into your community. Right. Your children go to school with them, and your children now get a I remember what a counselor said this. They hear horrors,
right,
from their refugee Syrian children's schoolmates,
right,
that have never been seen, or at least not very often seen in America. Okay.
Right.
And they themselves, too, suffer what's called a sort of secondary kind of trauma from exposure to these stories, mm-hmm. And so you have, and then you get parents saying, oh, no, I don't want my children to mess with that. I don't want them exposed to, half your family being blown up by car bombs every other day.
Right.
I don't want that. And then you start to get this thing going.
Right.
Tough.
Peter, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I'm not sure I can weigh in on Syria, but I can weigh in on this issue of, how do we deal with the issue of prosperity and growth? I remain, and Stuart knows this because of my history and the work that I've tried to do, I remain very committed to understanding that the U.S. remains a huge manufacturing country, and second only to China in terms of manufacturing production.
Mm-hmm.
Albeit a shrunken percentage of the workforce, about 12%, as opposed to 25% of the workforce in 1955 when the AFL and the CIO merged. But 12 million workers in manufacturing, and there's growth there, and there continues to be growth there. As you well know, you go into the South, there's whole manufacturing complexes that have grown up around captive auto plants.
Right.
With parts manufacturing, whatever.
Right.
But the challenge, as we know, is what kind of jobs are those jobs, and are they good union jobs? And the task remains, I'm sorry, the task remains to organize those manufacturing workers. And God bless the UAW for making some attempts to do that, and I hope others will begin to focus their resources on doing that, because I firmly believe that there's still manufacturing that locates in this country, either for questions of market, questions of technology, questions of supplier chain,
education,
and that we should not give up on that issue, that we need to project a vision of growth, but growth with unionism. And I don't think that's a dinosauric concept.
You know, that brings us back around to another point on global worker solidarity. As far as I know, and I spend a lot of time looking at this, the most successful organizing we've had in manufacturing has been, in the last 20 years, has been the UAW allying itself with metal workers unions and automobile unions in other countries, especially Germany, to pressure these employers to accept unionism and not to fight it and fire people and terminate people and make it all but impossible to organize. So I know that in the mid-2000s, the UAW organized 5,000 workers in North Carolina who worked at Freightliner truck manufacturing plants. They organized 1,000 workers at Thomas Built Bus. Both Freightliner and Thomas Built Bus were owned by Daimler Chrysler. And I'm going to slow down here so our listeners can follow this. Daimler Chrysler is a German corporation, and by German law, unions have to be, there have to be union slots on their board of directors. And those union slots made it possible for the UAW to organize and to get as far as the UAW has gotten at Volkswagen. They're not all the way there yet, but they're in a fight at Volkswagen, a viable fight, a winnable fight, because of IG Metall, which is the German metal workers union. We in America now are having to make up for decades of not providing much solidarity, global solidarity, to very much needing global solidarity today. To thrive in the future, I really believe the American labor movement and American workers and the American working class have to take the side of not just other Americans, but of people around the globe. Peter, thank you so much for being with us today. John, thank you so much for being with us. John is very kind. My leader, my great friend.
Stuart, I just want to thank you. It's been a really engaging hour. I loved it, and I loved spending time with you and reuniting with my UE brother, John Chase. This was a fabulous experience. I hope I can come back again with you guys.
Oh, absolutely.
I was mentioning earlier here, if I could, that West Virginia has such serious problems, Peter. We don't have an easy way out of it.
Right.
And I was wondering whether it might be worthwhile us asking to join California as a possible economic ally. We used to have Senator Byrd, who used to bring in all kinds of federal money, but we don't have that kind of pull anymore, apparently. So
now we want the leadership of Jerry Brown.
Any chance we can sign up?
Can we secede with y'all?
we were talking about that last night. Well, if we decide to go that way, we'll let you know.
Hey, gotcha. Hey, Peter, while you're in Boston, give your mama a hug for me and a kiss for me, and say hi to all my friends, Rand, and everybody else up there, John Walsh at IBW, and be good to yourself and Christina and your boy, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Yeah, Stuart, my son Nelson now is a fourth year apprentice in the IBW. So
oh, all right. Which local?
617 in San Mateo County.
That's great. Is he indoor wireman or is he a pole climber?
Yeah, inside wireman.
All right, there you go.
Are you still down in L.A., Peter, or are you up north?
No, I'm in San Francisco, John. Yeah. When John, if you guys come out west, John, I'd love to see you again. That would be fabulous.
Oh, yeah, we'd have a good time.
Next time I'm in the D.C. area, I'll
come up to Shepherdstown. We call it Paris on the Potomac here, okay?
Yeah, you got lots of friends up here, Peter.
Okay.
Okay, brothers. Hey, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you,
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.